Well, I am particularly happy to be here. Nice to come to session, and it's especially nice to come to session in Canada, a humane and civilized nation. I really appreciate Canada. I've been coming here for many years, but I think I appreciate it now more than ever. Session is a special time to be together. And it's a special way to be together. Last night, when Michael was speaking about session, he was using the word retreat, which is the word that we commonly use. But actually, session is not the same as a meditation retreat. I mean, it is a meditation retreat, but actually it's more than that. It's more like a ritual, a week-long ritual, an imaginative projection of a life infused at all points with the love and wisdom of the Buddha. It's not just us here meditating. It's really more than that. Now, of course, we do pay attention to the practice on the cushion. It's a huge part of session, of course. We pay attention the whole time. We're sitting. We're vigorous. We come back again and again and again to the body, to the breathing, to the ineffable fact of our human presence. And a lot of times, the attention flags, we lose our way, we lose the thread, and we remember, come back. Right away, as soon as we remember, we come back to the breath, we come back to the body, and we make that effort to come back over and over and over again with gentle strictness. So yeah, we are definitely making a serious effort on our cushions. And I would even say that in a quiet way, steadily, we are all making an heroic effort on our cushions. But not just on our cushions, we're also paying attention when we walk in Kinhin. We're there paying attention just as much. When we walk outside to go to the dining hall, we're paying attention just as much. It's really no different from when we're on our cushion. With our Oryoki practice, it's pretty obvious that when we're eating, we're not just eating. We are clearly performing a ritual. We're chanting. We're reflecting on our practice. We're remembering the point of eating a meal in the first place, of being in this human body in the first place. And we're eating the meal with all the decorum and mindfulness of a Buddha. Eating as we say, and we mean it. These are Buddha's bowls. When we walk into the Zendo, it's not just Tom, Dick, and Harry strolling into the Zendo to sit and meditate. No. We are sacred Buddhas, walking and moving with dignity. So we are creating together, with the rule of session, an imaginative atmosphere, a kind of theater of the soul, which is as real as, and perhaps more real than our everyday atmosphere, which is, after all, of course, also a created, imagined reality. And the purpose of this imagined reality is awakening. That's the purpose of it. That's why it is constructed the way it's constructed. Awakening is not the avowed purpose of ordinary life. But awakening is the explicit purpose of this imaginative projection. We would like to wake up from our dream of smallness, of painfulness. We would like to enter a much larger, much softer, much more beautiful world, full of surprises and possibilities. And you know, all of us see the world and believe, we really believe, that the way we see and feel the world, the way we see and feel ourselves, the way we see and feel our fellow human beings, we actually believe that that way is the way it really is. We believe it. It's a belief, and we believe it. We don't even think to question it. Probably we don't like it that much. Probably we wish it was some different way. But we do not question that it is the way we think it is. Ladies and gentlemen, it's not that way. Certainly it's not that way. We even already know this. We already know that the world is full of spaciousness. We literally know that. We know that things that appear to us as solid are not solid. They're full of space. We know this. We know that every person we meet is an endlessly open question, not the fixed, scary, distanced entity we think he or she is. We know this, but we don't feel it. We don't see it with our eyes. We don't hear it with our ears. And we certainly don't live in the world we know to be true. The world really is magical. It really is surprising. It really is constantly new. We don't have to make it that way. That's the way it is. All we have to do is stop clinging to our preconceptions, to our forced and conditioned smallness, and allow the world to come forth and awaken us, because that's what it will do if we let it. And allow that to happen, not just once in a while, a moment here, a moment there in Sesshin, but all the time. And that's why we take the enormous trouble that it takes to create this imaginative ritual of Sesshin. And I am so aware of how much it takes to put that blade of grass in the ground every year for 17 years and create this. That's why we bother to do this, so that it can be easier for us to live this wider and more surprising life and to really feel it all the way down to our toes. Probably it will take a certain amount of time for us to overcome our resistance and our complaining and our doubting, but we will do that soon enough. And then we can have some happiness. And Michael also reminded us last night that Sesshin is a co-production. It's not something we do by ourselves. We only do it together. And doing it together is one of its principal delights. Now, I understand that people can seem at first quite bothersome. I mean, they're so weird, these people. They're so odd. And they have a way of constantly getting underfoot. Have you noticed? They're always, you want to go there, somebody's in the way, you know, it's such a pain. Very annoying. Other people, very annoying. So the first couple days of session, there's a certain amount of that going on. But after a while, you begin to see how beautiful people are. Every single one. Because every single one is an absolutely unique, never before seen or heard miracle. A marvelous creature. And you come to feel a tremendous sympathy for each and every person in the session, even though you never talk to them. Maybe the whole time goes by and you never see them again, you never talk to them, and yet in the heart there's a tremendous sympathy for each and every person. The way this person moves, the way that person handles the Oryoki bowls, the way this person stands, the funny way that person walks, so endearing, so fabulous. This one sitting and crying softly on her cushion. That other one smiling some impish smile. Fabulous. And after a while, it occurs to you that your own thoughts and aches and pains and sorrows are very small compared to the place in your heart occupied by these heartbreakingly beautiful people. So lovely, so holy. And this feeling of absolutely belonging to one another is one of the great pleasures of Sesshin. And for those of us who have been doing this together for some time, 5 or 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 years together, having seen each other in that time through so much pain and joy, the pleasure is even stronger. So we know we belong to one another. We know we couldn't possibly do without one another. And I'm not talking here about friendship, our friends, we like each other. What I'm talking about is much more than that. Because even if one of us one day is gone, having entered the great and endless space that we designate with the word death, the connection is not over. The connection continues, just as strong, sometimes stronger, because it doesn't end. And we feel this sense of things too in Sesshin, with every breath in awareness, with every step that we take that's definite and distinct, with the sound of the bell, the striking of the han, with every prostration and every chanted word. Now, I realize that some of you are maybe a little new to Sesshin, and you might find it daunting. Possibly some of you are not that used to the ritual, and you're having the uncomfortable experience of feeling like you are clumsy, like everybody around you seems to know exactly what to do except for you. And this is a pretty normal feeling. And actually, when you think about it, it's quite interesting, isn't it? This kind of special kind of unpleasantness. Why should it be unpleasant? Well, we like to feel competent, right? We like to feel like we know what's going on. We like to feel like we're the guy in the know. The other people don't know. We know. We like that. We're on top of things. We like that. We don't like it when we don't feel like we know what's going on, when we feel like we're not on top of things. We like to be in control. We like to know what's happening. And when we feel a little out of control, it freaks us out, either a lot or slightly. And that's too bad. Because when it comes to the actually important things in life, we are not going to be able to be in control. So if we freak out when we're not in control, it's not going to go well. So Sesshin gives you this chance to get comfortable with your discomfort. It's a great opportunity. It gives you a chance to study your need for control and understand exactly how it creates pain. And it doesn't take long to get used to the ritual anyway. And maybe quickly you get used to it and you enjoy it. And there's another great thing about Sesshin. It creates new and arcane opportunities for enjoyment. Bowing, you know, making prostrations. Like, where can you go? And this is like one of the ways that you can have fun is making prostrations. There are not very many places where you can enjoy this wonderful chanting meaningless syllables in foreign languages. Where do you get to do that and enjoy it? But when you get used to doing these things and it becomes part of your life, it's a tremendous joy, you know, to do this. You can't explain it to other people, like why it is that you're chanting these syllables for 50 years and you just think it's great, even though you have no idea exactly what it's saying. So, cheap thrills is another advantage of Sesshin. But then there's the the kind of difficulty that's harder to take. Pain, physical pain, emotional pain. This comes up too in Sesshin, and that's okay. Ordinary life is almost entirely constructed around the strategy of how to minimize pain, even eliminate pain, and maximize pleasure and well-being, right? That's the whole point. Life is about maximize well-being and pleasure, eliminate pain if possible. But in Sesshin, and in our practice in general, we really get it that this is a doomed strategy. It really can't work. It's this very strategy that keeps our life small and drives our unhappiness. And in Sesshin, we have a chance to really examine and confront this strategy that's so habitual in all of us. In Sesshin, when there's pain, we recognize it. We understand it's pain. We don't think it's a problem. We don't think that it's a sign that we or someone else is doing something wrong. We understand pain and suffering is perfectly normal, perfectly natural. And when we learn how to turn toward it rather than away from it, in our very body, because you notice when you're sitting there, you don't even intend to do this, but your body, oddly, is trying to run away from itself when it's in pain, right? You can see that. It's crazy. But your body does this, even though you don't even know it. Now you see it. So in Sesshin, when we see this happening, we observe it, and instead of continuing this fruitless path of escaping the inescapable, we turn around and we face what's there. We soften into it gently, slowly. And then we get to see something really astounding. We get to see that we don't need to be afraid. We get to see that we're a lot stronger than we thought we were. We get to see how sometimes pain brings us joy and wisdom and opens our hearts. So, on a very concrete and practical level, if you're sitting on your cushion and something starts to hurt, your knee hurts, your back hurts, your neck hurts, don't just groan and complain and start figuring out how you're going to make the pain go away. Just be patient with it. Just breathe into it. Just study how your aversion and your fear is the direct cause of your distress. The truth is, an unpleasant physical sensation is not all that hard to bear. So this is a hugely important lesson you can learn in Sesshin, how to be more forbearing, how to deal with pain of all kinds. Now, I'm not saying that Sesshin is an exquisitely spiritualized form of masochism, or that it's the province of foolhardy individuals. Of course, if you have reason to think you're hurting yourself, adjust your posture. Take a rest. Change. But even then, don't baby yourself. Even then, extend your capacity little by little. No matter what your condition, no matter what your condition, you can be strong. You can learn more love and more empathy through paying attention to your pain, whatever kind of pain it is. Whatever you're suffering, others have suffered this also. In this same moment of your suffering, others are also suffering this same thing. We can remember that, and that will change us. In pain, in grief, in sorrow, in darkness, there's great profit. Darkness can be beautiful. It's calming if you know how to move within it, bear with it with some softness. There can even be joy at the heart of grief. And I know that some of you understand this very well. In fact, suffering is the first point in Buddha Dharma. As you know, Buddha was a strong young person, but his life was turned upside down by suffering. And it's interesting to remember that the Buddha himself was not suffering. But he saw, and he felt it personally, the suffering of others. The suffering of others really stung him, because it made him realize that this suffering is built into human life, that there is absolutely no way around it, and that whenever others suffer, it's also our suffering. He saw this. So his practice began with suffering, with caring, and this was his motivation. And this is what caused him to seek a different way of being human, an alternative to the constant battle for control and possession that marks so much of human life. He said, there's got to be another way. And he did find another way. If someone, you know, says, what's Buddhism? The shorthand way of explaining that is suffering and end of suffering. A lot of people come to practice because finally they notice suffering. Usually their own suffering. One's own suffering gets your attention more quickly. So people notice their own suffering. And they hear that Buddhism is suffering and end of suffering, so they hear all about meditation, make you more happy, live longer. Your suffering will end. And that's true, actually, only not quite in the one-dimensional way we think it's true. Because we think suffering means pain, and the end of suffering means cheerful pleasantness. So we think if we meditate, we'll become peaceful and cheerful. And as I say, fortunately or unfortunately, it's a bit more complicated than that. To find real happiness, we have to transform suffering, which is not the same as excising it or eliminating it. We can't eliminate suffering. As long as there's life, there's suffering. So that's a good thing, that there's suffering. If you're suffering, you can say to yourself, thank goodness I'm suffering, I'm alive. That's good. Better than the alternative. We're living beings. We're going to suffer. But when we mistake the suffering and grab hold of it by the sharp end, we cut ourselves up and we're bleeding all over the place. And then we start waving our suffering around, brandishing it like a sword, and then we start slashing everybody in the vicinity. So we have to instead learn how to hold our suffering, which is also others' suffering. Learn how to cradle it gently. And when we do that, then the suffering can be okay. And when it's time to suffer, okay, we can suffer. And when it's time for joy and delight, we can completely be joyful. It's possible to actually see this point in Sishin. And sometimes it's astonishing how in Sishin, like, you could be 1 minute in the depths of total despair, and the next minute happy as can be, happier than you've ever been in your life, and then the next minute, kaboom, back into despair. Like in 5 minutes, you know, you can go through all this. It's marvelous. So life is really a lot more interesting when you allow suffering in, when you're not afraid of suffering, when you don't take all the suffering personally, when you have some willingness. And little by little, we do learn this. In practice, it takes a while. And after you stop being frustrated by it, you will be astounded by how stupid you are. amazed by your persistence in making the same crazy, upside-down, stupid mistakes over and over and over and over again, even though you know better. It will astound you. You try so hard and it doesn't work. And the harder you try, the worse it gets. But don't worry, eventually Zazen will break you down. It'll sort of wash all that away. Sneaky Buddha will wash all that away. And naturally, you're going to see and live differently, and you won't even know how it happened. What? How did that happen? I still don't know what I'm doing. How did that happen? You might be stupid forever, but now you don't care. You don't mind. And not minding, you know, makes all the difference. Then you'd be like a person who's coming outside for the first time after having been locked up for a long while in a dark room, blinking around and looking at the world for the first time. So beautiful. So many interesting things going on all around. Even the terrible things are actually pretty interesting. This doesn't mean there are no tears. There are tears. But there's no more anguish. I know that in the mountain rain practice period, you've been studying how to be bodhisattvas in the world. Again, last night, Michael mentioned that although it might look like we're here escaping from the world for a while, actually, wherever we are, the whole world is there too. And Buddha knew this. So although in the beginning, his early teachings seem to say, renounce the world, get nirvana, escape. Later he said, well, yes, I said that, but that's just because you guys needed to hear that. There'd be no other way I could convince you unless I started there. But the truth is, the only way to practice is to practice for and with the whole world. Because there's no you without the whole world. If you're here, the whole world is here. I just can't really solve my own problem without also solving the human problem. I can't really love myself without learning how to love everything and everyone. So yes, being bodhisattvas in the world is the only way we can practice. Exactly what that looks like is going to be as different as each one of us is from each other one of us. Sometimes being a bodhisattva in the world is being a hermit in the mountains. Sometimes being a bodhisattva in the world is feeding people every day. Sometimes being a bodhisattva in the world is being a mother looking after a child. We can't know what it means. We just have to keep mind and heart open and follow the orders that we will be given from the world. See who and what and where we are right now and do what we can do in the position that we're in at the moment. So we're also in practice period in the Everyday Zen group in the Bay Area. And we're similarly studying how to be bodhisattvas in the world. Specifically, we've been studying how to develop compassion. So we've been practicing with the Lojong slogans. And our Shuso, Jean Evans, down there, she made a schedule of slogans, a slogan for every day of the practice period. So I thought that was really good. Then I didn't have to wonder, like, what am I going to talk about today? I just look up on the list what the slogan is. And I'm trying to get her to organize the rest of my life that way. Like, give me a list of things I'm supposed to say, and then I'll know what to say. So she did that. So today I want to bring up these slogans for yesterday and today. First, if it's possible that some of you are not familiar with these teachings, so I'm going to give you a very brief background about these Lojong slogans. This is a very famous practice of Indo-Tibetan Buddhism, a practice for how to cultivate compassion. Now, as a Mahayana school of Buddhism, Zen, of course, is all about compassion. It's maybe about nothing else other than compassion. After all, in a minute and every day we chant, beings are numberless, I vow to save them, and we're serious about this. This is really our commitment, even though, as Michael pointed out, this is seems to be impossible. We don't care. We don't care. Zen is compassion practice. Everything about Zen practice, including, maybe especially including, relations with Sangha members and teachers, which are so important to us, are all for the purpose of training in compassion. But classical Zen doesn't much talk about compassion. It doesn't have a compassion discourse because it's completely understood. You wouldn't be here in the monastery if this is not your goal. So in Zen, it's not spoken of explicitly. So we Westerners, we don't get that. So that's why it's so important for us to be more explicit on the subject of compassion, which is why I've been bringing up the Indo-Tibetan teachings and Lojong practices for a long time now. And the classical text is called Seven Points of Mind Training, or Seven Points of Training the Heart. And the idea is there's seven different points with 59 slogans organized under these 7 points. I know most of you know this. The 7 points are: point one, resolve to begin. We begin with finding motivation at the deepest possible level. Second, train in empathy and compassion. Learn how to stretch your heart. Just like you stretch your muscles in yoga, stretch your heart. Three, transform bad circumstances into the path, which is what I've been talking about this morning, learning how to turn toward rather than away from pain. Four, make practice your whole life. Get over the idea that practice is a thing that you do in the Zendo, or it's a item on your list of things that you have to take care of and do. It's not that. It's your life. Fifth, assess and extend. Learn how to check yourself and extend your practice. Sixth, the discipline of relationship. We practice always with others. So flip the way you have been living your life with others from self-protection and give me what I need to love. And seven, living with ease in a crazy world. That's the seventh point. Anyway, these are my interpretations of the 7 points. Everybody who talks or writes about them has a slightly different interpretation. So these are the 7 points as I describe them in Training in Compassion, my book on these teachings. So you can read about it. There are lots of great books about these teachings. Of course, hearing about them, reading about them is just the beginning. Anyway, the point of all this is to show that spiritual practice is only a matter of living in the world as it actually is, with others, and with all the world's difficulties. That this human life, these other people, this troubled world is given to us as a path. That's our practice. And the overarching idea is that self-centeredness, which is so common, so ingrained, none of us escape it, is the source of our unhappiness. All our fear and trouble and terror comes from this. And that love and concern is just as natural to us, and the more we can develop love and concern for others, the more true happiness we can have. So we're trying to shift little by little from one to the other. And it's more than wanting to. It takes effort, subtle effort over time. And this is what we have to train in. Seeing our self-centeredness over and over again, seeing how painful it is over and over again, and extending our heart towards others. So in a nutshell, that's the whole point of the Lojong training. So it's toward the end of the practice period here and also in the Bay Area. And we're going to conclude our practice period soon after I return, November 20th, with a Shuso Hosen, a question and answer period, just as we will conclude our session here with a Shuso Hosen, which Vicky is very excited about and can hardly wait. She's looking forward to it. But anyway, since we're toward the end, we're on the final group of slogans under the seventh point, living with ease in a crazy world. Now, I think that today we understand more than ever how crazy the world is. In fact, I think even now, various mental health professionals are producing diagnoses, you know, of what's wrong with the crazy world. Of course the world is crazy. Of course it is. When we were children, naturally, we believed that the adults knew what they were doing and that the world was sane. And it has been quite a shock that most of us have not yet gotten over to realize that actually there are very, very few adults around, and that the world is crazy and seems to be getting crazier all the time. We should not be surprised. A wise person is never surprised by human folly. It's completely normal, and it is to be expected. And yet, we don't need to be made crazy by the crazy world. There is a way to live in this actual world, the way it is, gracefully. And that's the slogans under the seventh point are all about that. So the slogans for yesterday and today. Yesterday's slogan is the 53rd, don't vacillate. Today's slogan is 54, be wholehearted. So I'm going to read you some commentaries, brief commentaries to these slogans. And these are from a book called The Intelligent Heart by Dzigar Khontrol Rinpoche. It's a really great commentary to the Lojong teachings. 53, don't vacillate. We tend to go back and forth in our priorities. Sometimes we focus on accomplishing our spiritual goals, devoting many hours a day, and we feel really committed. And then the next thing you know, we're caught up in ambitions of the conventional world, and we completely lose the intention to practice. This kind of inconsistency undermines our self-confidence and prevents us from making any progress. Sometimes we may fall into self-satisfaction. This is never a good idea. If we're complacent about our path, we will never do what it takes to drive the tenacious rascal of self-importance back into the corners of our heart. This slogan urges us not to check out. There's no such thing as a vacation from working with our heart. It's like taking a vacation from being a human being, you know. You get one soon enough. There's no rush. We should continually contemplate how we can go deeper in our practice. Training the heart requires nothing external. You don't even need a cushion. All you need is a heart, and you have that all the time. So yes, training in compassion. Zen practice is so clear on this point. We practice all the time, every day, in every single thing we do. There is no end to the practice. So it makes no sense to think about getting it right or getting it wrong or making progress. There's no progress in an infinite journey. We're always going to get it right and we're always going to get it wrong. And to be clear, don't vacillate doesn't mean don't vacillate. It doesn't mean that. What it means is when you vacillate, understand that it's vacillation. Know it for what it is. Turn around and get on track as soon as possible. That's what don't vacillate means. 54, be wholehearted. Unless we're fully committed to the practice, we won't succeed in getting rid of our self-importance. This slogan encourages us to make this commitment rather than merely testing the practice to see if it works, to really be committed to it. To avoid practicing with a half-hearted, second-guessing attitude, we need to understand what we're doing. As my teacher, Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, often used to say, it's important to practice, but first you need to learn how to practice. Learning how to practice gives us the confidence to do it wholeheartedly. If we understand the benefits of Lojong, if we know how it works, if we grasp the relationship between the practice and our own heart, and if we trust in its effectiveness, we will naturally train wholeheartedly. We will naturally train to become bodhisattvas the way athletes train for the Olympics. On the outer level, we'll exert ourselves, and on the inner level, which is even more important, we'll always line up our heart with the teachings. So this is another beautiful benefit of Sesshin, this whole apparatus of Sesshin makes the practice of wholeheartedness very clear. The only way you can do Sesshin is wholeheartedly. And it's the genius of our Zen ancestors to have created for us this imaginative container of practice that's set up for us to just have to do what is to be done moment after moment. To sit when the bell rings. To eat when it's time to eat. To sleep when it's time to sleep. To work and do our task wholeheartedly and with full attention. Doing each thing because this is the only thing to be done now. And the only way to do it is completely. So all you have to do is trust the arrangements. All you have to do is give yourself to each and every thing as it comes. And soon you'll find some joy. The joy of liberation from yourself. The joy of liberation from your own strangling preferences. And then others will appear to you. And this will be a great relief. So I'm grateful for Sesshin. I really enjoy it. And I'm grateful to all of you for being here, because I wouldn't be doing this by myself. And your being here gives me a great hope for the world. And I know that together we can do something, little by little, maybe without even noticing it. And we will all be okay. And I'm especially grateful today to dear Ninen, Susan, for letting us make her be the shining Buddha on our altar, so that all of us could, with her, through her, receive Buddha's clothing and Buddha's precepts. She is our dear Dharma sister, and we are all depending on her and on our mountain rain teachers and Sangha members. And of course, on our Shuso, we depend on each other. On the one hand, let's be honest, we are just a bunch of ordinary people trying to get through the day like everybody else. That's true. And on the other hand, what a blessing we are to one another, and how extraordinary is this collection of bodhisattvas. I believe it. So, from the bottom of my heart, thanks to all of you. So, I think we know what to do. May our intention equally extend to every